It is Wednesday, October 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, as U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo heads back from talks with Saudi and Turkish officials concerning the disappearance of a Saudi journalist, we look at European reaction to the situation.
They are hedging their comments. It's really the opposition partisan rights campaigners and, interestingly, business people who are being more outspoken.
Canada legalizes recreational marijuana, and the Invictus Games in Australia give wounded veterans a chance to heal emotionally as well as physically. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Turkish officials in Ankara Wednesday, seeking information about the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The writer was last seen heading into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd. On Tuesday, Pompeo held talks with Saudi leaders. He said the Saudis didn't want to talk about the facts concerning the missing journalists. Pompeo spoke to the news media in Brussels as he headed back to Washington concerning his talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
We talked about the Khashoggi incident as well. He made clear that the Saudis had cooperated with the investigation that the Turks are engaged in and that they're going to share information that they learned with the Saudis as well. There had been a couple of delays, but they seemed pretty confident that the Saudis would permit them to do the things that they needed to do to complete their thorough and complete investigation as well.
Wednesday at the White House, President Donald Trump spoke of the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia has been a very important ally of ours in the Middle East. We are stopping Iran. We're not trying to stop. We're stopping Iran. We went a big step when we took away that ridiculous deal that was made by the previous administration. The Iran deal, which was $150 billion and $1.8 billion in cash. What was that all about? And they are an ally. We have other very good allies in the Middle East. But if you look at Saudi Arabia, they're an ally and they're a tremendous purchaser of not only military equipment, but other things. When I went there, they committed to purchase $450 billion worth of things and $110 billion worth of military. Those are the biggest orders in the history of this country, probably the history of the world. I don't think there's ever been any order for $450 billion. And you remember that day in Saudi Arabia where that commitment was made. So they're an important ally, but I want to find out what happened, where is the fault, and we will probably know that by the end of the week.
Jamie Detmer in London tells me European leaders are also walking a fine line concerning their own relationships with Riyadh in regard to Khashoggi.
They've issued various statements of concern. They've made demands for a full inquiry. They have talked about, in varying degrees but heavily hedged, about being serious consequences in terms of the relationship between the European governments and Saudi Arabia if it is proven that the Saudi leadership had a hand in Khashoggi's disappearance and likely murder. But as I said, they are hedging their comments. It's really the opposition partisan rights campaigners and, interestingly, business people who are being more outspoken. And what officials both in Britain and Germany have said to me is that they're really trying to find a way to project their outrage at what happened to this Saudi journalist, U.S. resident, of course, while at the same time trying to keep intact what they see as a very important alliance.
Yes, because if Khashoggi was killed, which is what is rumored at this point, this took place in a country that did take place in a Saudi consulate, but it took place in a country that's a member of NATO.
Absolutely. And also, of course, you have with European governments this point that they constantly make that they are defenders of a rule-based system of global governance, that they're interested in global norms. And they have criticized very heavily and condemned very heavily, for example, Russian actions when they were extraterritorial. Emily Thornberry, the Labour Foreign Affairs spokesman, was saying, you know, the reaction would be much tougher if this was something that the Russians had done or the Iranians had done, and that there's a blind spot, really, from the West when it comes to Saudi actions, and particularly this very aggressive foreign policy that we've seen the Crown Prince pursue. The counter to that, of course, is that, first of all, it is a major oil exporter and can cause tremendous disruption to Western economies. And officials are also saying privately that you've got to look at the bigger picture, that in the end the Saudis are a reliable ally, the only reliable Arab state ally they have in the region. It's an important arms market for them as well. And in Britain's case, of course, it had been earmarked as a country post-Brexit that they could improve their trading links with. But again, you know, rights campaigners were saying that's a very short-sighted view, that you shouldn't base all your relationship on those kind of strategic and economic interests, because you also damage yourselves in terms of reputation if you maintain close ties with a country that may have committed an extraterritorial killing.
And also there is the fact that Saudi's arch rival in the area is Iran, and that plays sort of a role in this whole equation too.
Yes, it does. It's a factor in the minds of officials, I think, particularly in London, but right across Europe. You know, one of the fears is that if they back away from Saudi Arabia so much, Iran will be the beneficiary, will play it to their advantage. And we are at this stage now when the US are about to impose oil sanctions on Iran. The Europeans are keen to keep the nuclear arms deal that America has walked away from going, but they don't particularly want to see Iran become a stronger power in the region and in the Middle East as well. So there are a lot of factors here. There is clearly amongst governments and officials here considerable outrage at this action, and particularly if it's shown to have been ordered by the Saudi leadership. But at the same time, they're trying to weigh that up with their own strategic and economic interests.
Just out of curiosity, did you know Khashoggi?
I'd met him a couple of times. I didn't know him well. I was a keen reader of his columns. He was a man, of course, who would push back at the idea that he was a dissident. He felt that he was a loyal critic. It was a very strong voice, a very reform-minded voice, and he was a man who was very skeptical about the Crown Prince's own credentials as a reformer. He has been a fixture in Washington for a while now. His voice is very much heeded in the corridors of power and on Capitol Hill, and was quite a figure, really, in the think tank world in Washington. So there's a personal element, I think, really, in how the media and analysts are talking about him, because a lot of people knew him very well and respected him.
Jamie Detmer, reporting from London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. An attack on a Crimean technical college kills 18 people. An Indian minister quits following the hashtag MeToo allegations. First Lady Melania Trump's plane suffers a mechanical issue, and a U.S. envoy says some militants have withdrawn from Syria's Idlib area. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Over the course of Earth's history, there have been 5 mass extinction events when large numbers of species died over somewhat short periods of time. Some scientists say that we are in the midst of a 6th mass extinction event called the Holocene extinction. It's also referred to as the Anthropocene extinction because, unlike the previous 5 events, which are said to have been caused by natural or geological processes, this extinction event is being caused by humans. A new Danish-Swedish study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests that animal and plant species are dying so fast that nature cannot keep up. The study also proposes that unless there's an improvement in conservation efforts, many mammal species will become extinct within the next 50 years, and that it would take between 3 and 5 million years for nature to recover. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at reports saying that the Trump administration is considering plans to separate parents and children at the U.S.-Mexico border. Canada on Wednesday became only the second and largest country in the world after Uruguay to legalize the sale and recreational use of marijuana. The medicinal use of marijuana has been legal in Canada since 2001. The legal age is either 18 or 19, depending on which of the 13 provinces or territories you're in, and marijuana will be sold in either private or government-run stores or a mix. It can also be purchased on approved websites. It will still be a crime to supply marijuana to minors. The issue was part of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's campaign platform in 2015, and Parliament approved it in June. University of Toronto political science professor Nelson Wiseman tells International Edition's Victor Beatty most of the controversy surrounding the issue has subsided since last year in a tug-of-war between the provinces and the federal government over implementation, where illegal marijuana cafes and lounges have operated in Canada for years.
There are about 100 operating right now in the country under the idea that they're providing medicinal marijuana. Not much will be changing on October 17 because there are different regimes for distribution and sale in every single province. In some of the rules aren't going to be coming in until next April. What I suspect is that the current shops will now start selling recreational marijuana, even though they're not licensed to do so.
Was this a campaign pledge made by Prime Minister Trudeau?
It was a campaign pledge, but a number of other things have happened. And he himself, I should say, has admitted that he had smoked marijuana. What I would say is that public opinion has shifted, as has the views of the police community. A poll that came out yesterday indicated that 70% of Canadians support or accept the legalization of recreational marijuana. Only 30% are opposed. With respect to the police, they recognized that they were waging a losing battle. For the last 10, 15 years, many police forces were suggesting, look, this isn't working. It's a huge waste of resources. This is what we were also hearing from prosecutors, and a new strategy had to be adopted.
Is there a concern about the effects that marijuana may have, for instance, on driving and other duties?
Yes, there is a concern, and 1,300 police officers have had some training to try to spot impairment. What will happen is that we'll feel our way around this. It is the case that Canada is the first major industrialized country that is legalizing recreational marijuana. But the largest of the industrialized countries, of the G7 countries, the United States, we've got a legal regime in Colorado and in Washington.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection invited Canadian media to a conference call Tuesday so officials could repeat that marijuana remains illegal under U.S. federal law and that those who are caught at the border with pot are subject to arrest and prosecution. Do you think legalizing this across Canada will prompt a change in federal law in the U.S.?
My understanding is that border agents on the American side are not going to be, except in unusual circumstances, asking every person who comes across, are you carrying marijuana? And I should also point out that it's illegal for Canadians to carry marijuana across the border when they return to Canada, and that Canadian Border Services is going to make a point of asking everyone coming into Canada whether they are carrying it. Currently, Canadian border agents ask if you're bringing back alcohol or tobacco because there are limits on how much you can bring in to the country. And now they will also add marijuana to that list.
University of Toronto political science professor Nelson Wiseman. Canadian adults will be allowed to possess, carry, or share up to 30 grams of marijuana. Smoking in public places will be restricted and will remain illegal in workplaces. Drivers will face fines or prison time if found to be under the influence. Canadians with a criminal record for marijuana possession before the law went into effect can apply for a pardon. A recent report in the Washington Post said the Trump administration is actively considering plans that could again separate parents and children at the U.S.-Mexico border, but would add options to previous approaches. The report said the plans are under consideration because of the soaring number of families trying to enter the U.S. illegally from Mexico. President Trump seemed to validate that at a news conference on Monday.
And we're very tough on the border, and we have to be very tough on the border. So we're looking at all immigration laws. They are a disaster. They're a laughingstock all over the world.
Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Ashkan Emami spoke with International Edition's Lori London. She told him that a court already ordered the administration to reunite families separated at the border, and not all have been reunited. She asked if this new plan is expected to be done in a way that doesn't violate the law and spark more legal action.
So the invisible wall keeps rising and rising under this administration, and you're correct that there was a court order ruling that these families be reunited. So the issue now is not so much the reunification of the families, but the issue is whether the Department of Homeland Security has the right, the legal right, to keep these families together and then make a choice on whether and when to separate the families. And a lot of this goes back to some case law that's about 20 years old, which is known as the Flores Settlement, which basically allows the Department of Homeland Security to detain alien minors, as they're referred to, along with their families, but they have to, in pretty short order, put them into a detention center that is basically up to standard based on this settlement. What the administration is arguing is that these non-secure state-licensed facilities don't really exist. And the ones that do exist are not able to house both the children and the parents together. So the administration is now saying we'll comply to a certain extent with the law, we'll keep the families together for 20 days. After 20 days, since none of these facilities are available for them, we'll have the parents make a choice. They're referring to it as the binary choice. They either stay with their children in the detention for months or years as their cases proceed, or they allow the children to be taken to a government shelter and then relatives or other people who are in the United States legally can take custody of them. That's sort of the loophole that they're trying to take advantage of. That based on the law, that none of these suitable facilities are available, so they have no choice now, and they have to separate the families one way or another, or make them stay in immigration jail for years.
The First Lady recently, in an interview, said she was blindsided by this whole family separation policy and she didn't think it was a good idea. And she said the president doesn't like it either. This would seem to contradict that. Or is this just something from the Justice Department that the White House isn't involved in, although the president certainly seemed to be in favor of it to some degree during the interview?
If she was blindsided, it's because she was not paying attention. There has been and continues to be a clear zero tolerance policy in this administration, and children are not exempt from that. It's very, very obvious that the president is well aware of what's happening. Not only was he aware of it, but after the backlash, even after the court order, now the administration is trying to re-implement it in a different way. I don't see any way that they could have been, quote-unquote, blindsided by this.
Do you know the status of the children that have still not been reunited with their families and their parents? We've heard that some children are actually being put up for adoption, and we've also heard
right.
that a lot of the parents have already been deported. So how do they locate them?
Right. It's very hard to say. There's a lot of conflicting information. There are still lots of people pouring in every day. To speak to your point that you made very, very early on, this has not really been a deterrent. So people are still coming. The problem is compounding. It's hard to get accurate information. There's a recent court filing, and the Department of Justice admitted that over 400 parents have been deported without their children. Only a small fraction of those signed a form agreeing to relinquish their child to a relative. There are approximately, the administration claims that 130 parents voluntarily agreed to leave their kids and go back home. But it looks like there was a lot of coercion and duress. They used the children to sort of leverage these departures. So it's really hard to say what's happening, but we do know that there's definitely a lot of kids who are still separated from their parents, either still in detention or they've been taken into the custody of relatives, and plenty of other things, I think, that have yet to be uncovered.
Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Ashkan Emami, he spoke with International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. Britain's Prince Harry will open the Invictus Games in Australia this weekend. The competition for injured servicemen and women, along with veterans, will attract 500 athletes from 18 countries. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Invictus means unconquered or undefeated in Latin. It's the name given to a Paralympic-style event co-founded in 2014 by Britain's Prince Harry, who served in the army for 10 years and went on two tours of Afghanistan. The prince was inspired after he attended a similar event for wounded veterans in the United States. There have been three Invictus Games so far, in London in 2014, Orlando in Florida in 2016, and Toronto in Canada in 2017. The fourth installment starts Saturday in Sydney. The event will officially be opened by Prince Harry, who's arrived in Australia on a royal tour.
I'm particularly grateful to the Australian government for hosting the Invictus Games, which the whole country has embraced with great enthusiasm. Thank you so much for all of the support. Australia is, of course, home to some of the world's best sporting talent, but what you are about to see during these Invictus Games will quite literally astound you. A demonstration of the power of the human spirit, the power of sport to change lives.
The games bring together hundreds of athletes from 18 countries who are all military allies, including Afghanistan, France, Iraq, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Former Australian commando Gary Robinson was in a Black Hawk helicopter when it crashed in 2010 in enemy territory in Afghanistan. He suffered a severe brain injury and a fractured lower spine. His left leg was later amputated below the knee. He's now competing in his fourth Invictus Games.
I'm very honoured and very proud. I've always said to my therapist, I can't wait till the day comes that Invictus does come to Australia. So it has saved my life. And to be able to be supported and acknowledged by my home countrymen, for me, would be the pinnacle of my recovery. You will see me competing in cycling, archery and swimming.
Many of the events will be hosted at the same venues used for the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. They include athletics, sitting volleyball, wheelchair basketball and powerlifting. The sailing and road cycling competitions will take place in and around Sydney Harbour. The Invictus Games run from October 20 to 27. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.